Monsieur Briand by Sarah Johnson. Part 1. Jules César Bétraud returned to Saint-Séché when he was thrown out of school in Montauban. Not that he really wanted to be in Saint-Séché, but he still had free run of the house there, for his father, though almost perpetually absent, had somehow kept up on the property taxes. Jules thought that with any luck his father might not find out about the expulsion until the term was over or later. Bétraud, Sr., trying to peddle stock in a rising aircraft manufacturer, was supposed to be in Lyon, or thereabouts, or had been heard of from there in February, so Jules feared no imminent paternal wrath when he stepped off the bus in Saint-Séché. Of course, there was a strong chance that he would be recognized by someone, and the news of his arrival bandied about, until someone in possible correspondence with Papa Bétraud, such as Lawyer Guillaume, might tattle, and Jules had plotted a few schemes of disfigurement, involving chocolate, shoe polish, or cigarette ash, in the last few leagues of the ride, the long, and to him, dull, descent into the valley of the Dordogne, but intelligently did not carry any of them out. He merely stepped off, hoisted his bag on his shoulder like a soldier back from the Rhine crossing in Berlin, thought about a poignant imitated limp, didn't, and slunk to the tall house with grey and plaster on Rue du Faubourg La Chabanais, climbed up the pear tree to the second-floor bathroom window, and let himself in. Money would not be a problem, at least for a while. He had withdrawn the whole amount his father, generous and negligent, had deposited as living on money for the second semester. He found that Director Lunard's letter to his father about the expulsion had reached Saint-Séché before him, and was lying under the letter slot. He tore it in small bits and flushed it down the commode. The water was running. His father must have paid the bill recently. Jules thought it a frightening sign that his father might be thinking of coming home soon, but could not know what to conclude. The whole afternoon, having nothing useful to do, and not particularly wanting to go see anyone in his present disgrace, he wandered about the large, musty house. His mother had taken all her wedding furniture with her, on going back to her parents 6 years before, and only what was ugly, useless, or bought in an emergency remained. The electricity was not on. Jules went up to his old room, found that mice had chewed up his bedding, and went and got the sheets from his father's bed. He had left his room decently tidy on his last visit, 10 months ago, and found that an immense comfort now, compared to the skimpy disorder of the rest of the house. He took an encyclopedia. The bacteria, Jules César, isolated from the culture boarding school as fellow rascalum for at least 24 hours, becomes a methodical literate boy. He read it under the window until it was too dark to read, and with a sigh, closed the bright, warm life of Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus, to find his dim and chilly room again. He ate the chocolate, and part of a curiously bread-flavored post-war sausage that were still in his bag, took his shoes off, and then, out of sheer hatred for his erstwhile science professor, an atheist and admirer of Voltaire, he got down on his knees by the bed and began to say his prayers. But he had said prayers too regularly and with too kind a mother for his mind not to feel around, in the ash of the petitions, for a live coal of comfort now. He was in sore need of comfort, not to mention his mother. "Ah, mon Dieu, I have been rather bad, but I am alone now and cold. I need to live better. Please help me, let me know what to do. Amen." He did not like to sleep with the chocolate in his teeth, so he got up, rinsed his teeth in the extremely cold and shockingly Saint-Séché flavored water at the bathroom sink, went and lay down, and slept till morning. After a passable breakfast of ancient tinned biscuit and jam, about 8 in the morning, he was trying to pick up around the kitchen a bit when he heard a key turn in the front door. He froze, considered dashing back upstairs, and knowing that he probably had no chance because the stairs were in front of the door, walked quickly to it and pulled it open just as it became unlocked. The stranger did not seem at all surprised. He was of moderate height, a man perhaps 48 or 49, in a slightly worn brown jacket and trousers, and clean black hat, his shoes as scuffed and home-repaired as anyone's in Fourth Republic France. He smiled pleasantly at Jules, the faint lines just under his eyes crinkling, and his mustache exposing the tips of his upper teeth. "Charles Bétraud's son?" "Yes, Jules César." Jules, of course, looked suspicious and unfriendly. He did not recognize the visitor at all, and he intelligently held the door only partway open, and steeled himself to answer questions, though his sensibilities were already plotting mutiny, were inclining themselves to like the fellow. "I've been appointed to dwell in this house. It's deteriorating, and I've been granted permission to live in it and be its caretaker for 6 months. Unless its absentee owner can make other arrangements. Would you like to examine my commission?" Jules was a mere 16, and knew nothing about the dealings of the mayor and corporation, except that they seemed to be very arbitrary, and could pass almost anything they wanted. If he had been 20, he probably would have said, "That's outrageous! I'm contacting Lawyer Guillaume." But he only accepted the offer of a look at the commission, feeling very small and put upon, and looked it over, satisfied himself that it was very abstruse and legal-looking, and handed it back with a meek, "What are your, qualifications to be a caretaker?" Page 3. The document was handed back. Joel dutifully turned to page 3, dutifully baffled himself, and handed it over again. "You don't have a lot of personal stuff to move in?" he almost pleaded. The man picked up what looked like an empty piece of Cordovan hand luggage. "No, if you'll show me upstairs, I'll take up residence in the bedroom that's needed least, whichever it is." Jules showed him the small front room overlooking the street. "What's your name?" he ventured, as the outrageous gentleman pulled some shirts out of the empty-looking bag and put them in a bureau drawer. The fellow turned his face to Jules again, and Jules struggled again not to like him. "Briand, Monsieur Briand, at your service, Jules César." Jules bowed before he quite knew what he was doing. Then, so that he could see the face again, he said, "You're about the age to have fought in the war." "That is right," said Monsieur Briand, looking at him again and smiling again. "I fought in Le Caire." "You weren't hurt or anything?" said Jules politely, with mild curiosity. "No." Jules figured he had said enough, and went downstairs again. He had decided against trying to wire his father about this preposterous intrusion. An explanation of why he himself happened to invade the house would be necessary. Besides, it might turn out to be good to have a caretaker around. Maybe he would cook. Joel had no reliable idea of what a caretaker was, a servant or a landlord. He would wait and see. At least, it wouldn't be so deadly lonely with Monsieur Briand around, and maybe he would exterminate the mice. Monsieur Briand came down precisely 8 minutes after Joel did. He walked into the salon, where Jules was staring at the ashy fireplace, lost in thought, and clearing his throat said, "Jules César." Jules swung around. "I was given permission to use the cooking facilities, but I thought I'd better consult you. Is it convenient for you if I use La Cuisine sometimes? 3 times a day? I'll keep it clean." "Go ahead," said Jules, unable to say anything else. Monsieur Briand went to the front door and dragged in a sack of coal and a bundle of kindling which he must have had delivered to the door. He went into the kitchen and began to build a fire in the stove. Jules stood in the salon and listened, still staring at the fireplace, to each distinct scrape, rattle or click of kindling, match, stove door, draft. At last he heard the stove door propped open and a frying pan placed over one of the burners. He tiptoed to the kitchen doorway, looked in, and saw Monsieur Briand produce a flat package from under his coat, untie it on the table, and fold the paper back from 1/2 pound of bacon, some parsley, 4 eggs, and a tomato. Joel knew that the rationing was not as severe in Saint-Céré as in Montauban, but the sight of such a quantity of meat and eggs was shocking. He sucked the breath in through his teeth to control his saliva, and Monsieur Briand saw him. "Come in, Joel César. There will be enough for two." After the excellent breakfast, Monsieur Briand made a proposition. "Only a man who's alone in life is appointed a caretaker. A man who doesn't even own a dog, for that matter, and one who isn't likely to have visitors. And only a lonely boy would live in the kind of house that has to have a caretaker appointed. How would you like me to look after you a bit, Joel César? Cook your breakfast and dinner. Not that I wouldn't mind a little help. Remind you not to stay out too late and keep you in clean bedding." But the collaboration that worked out, over the next week or two, was a good deal more than that. Jules dried the dishes that Monsieur Briand washed. Jules hung out the laundry that Monsieur Briand washed. Jules watched Monsieur Briand mend the chimney and held his ladder for him. Jules stood down on the street and talked to Monsieur Briand about the war, while Monsieur Briand washed the windows. Monsieur Briand had some odd ideas about the war. He seemed, for instance, to have been personally acquainted with every one of the German soldiers that he had seen shot, and with several French, British, and American generals. Not that he bragged about it. When the evidence slipped out, he seemed particularly on his guard, even reticent. Jules sweated when he saw Monsieur Briand looking at the pear tree. He knew that that pear tree had no right to be there. When practically every other tree in the Lot district had been cut down for charcoal in the war years, and when Monsieur Bertraud's refusal to have his pear tree cut down, even in the coldest winter of the war, had made talk enough in the town. Talk of which, like the rest of Saint-Sacre's talk, with its muttering populist sentiments in Pujade's bookstore, Charles Bertraud was loftily ignorant in his trans-district rangings, but which his wife had not enjoyed at all. To have it sound out of her ears was probably one strong reason for that removal to her parents in Arriac. Jules felt a little complicit in his father's tree hoarding, simply because he loved the pear tree, and had climbed it even when all Saint-Sacre was hating his father for it. When he found Monsieur Briand staring at it with a smile of tolerant amusement, Jules shrank behind a corner of the wall. He was not entirely ignorant, even in his juvenility and after his long absence, of how the men of Lot liked to take things into their own hands, and became slightly afraid that Monsieur Briand, simply because he was such a thorough, expeditious, and so far very righteous man, might decide to cut down the guilty pear tree. Jules peered around the wall. Monsieur Briand was looking directly at him. "Jules César, are you fond of pears?" Jules nodded slowly, staring. "This is a fine pear tree, and probably the only one of its size and kind in the town," continued Monsieur Briand conversationally, pulling a branch down to examine the buds where blossoms would appear. Jules played the words over in his mind, searching for a tone of irony, and had not quite satisfied himself about this when Monsieur Briand spoke again. "Jules César, if you haven't got a father about, at least you have a tree. No one will cut this tree down." Jules continued to stare dumbly while Monsieur Briand placed a hand on the trunk. "No, no one will ever cut this tree down." He straightened, smiled broadly at Jules, and walked back to his buckets and ladder. Jules stared at the tree, and wondered idly whether Monsieur Briand were involved in one of those communist organizations, of which Jules himself had only the vaguest notion, derived from overhearing his Montauban professor's extracurricular talk. His main idea of the communists was that they killed Nazi collaborators after the liberation, that there were a lot of them all over the place, but you never knew one when you saw one, and that they exercised a lot of invisible control. It was easy for Jules to imagine that if a communard promised you that your pear tree would never be cut down, it would stand till the end of time. He tried to make up his mind for some time after that to ask Monsieur Briand some sly question that would reveal his communist views if he had any. He finally nerved himself to ask Monsieur Briand if he read the communist-leaning newspaper Le Patriot. The question fumbled out with profound embarrassment, and Monsieur Briand looked hard at Jules, and then smiled and tousled Jules' hair. "Le Patriot has its faults," he said, and Jules asked no more. Jules obliged Monsieur Briand two or three times by reading aloud to him in the evening. Monsieur Briand was never seen to read anything for himself, and while Monsieur Briand showed an odd kind of piteous contempt for most of the books in the house, he insisted that Jules should read the Bible. Monsieur Briand never read the Bible himself, any more than he read anything, but he said it was the best book in the world. The book Monsieur Briand appeared to enjoy most was Monsieur Bertraud's copy of Molière's Tartuffe, which Jules picked haphazard from the books in his father's room to read aloud one night. Monsieur Briand laughed and laughed while he was hearing it, a low, pleasant laugh, mocking, but so light and congenial that even Molière could hardly have been offended when Monsieur Briand laughed over the most serious lines and frowned at what were obviously intended to be funniest. Jules learned to be very comforted, coming home in the evening from whatever he had found to do, much walking, and some experimental swimming in Le Bave, by the sight of Monsieur Briand sitting on an iron chair against the house wall, with his feet in the street, resting from a day of his omniproficient plastering or moss scraping, mending the window boxes, or the kitchen plumbing. Monsieur Briand's pipe always glowed through the dark from a long way off. He smoked an odd sort of tobacco, which looked, even smelled a little, like dried rose petals. End of part one. Monsieur Briand by Sarah Johnson. Part two. Jules had needed a father for a long time, and he took to Monsieur Briand, or rather was taken to him, by a sometimes tremendous inner pull, which he never bothered to examine too closely. 16 often rides the waves of whatever is tremendous and inner without examining. Jules learned to walk up to Monsieur Briand's iron chair in the dusk, stop, stand beside, leaning against the wall and looking up at the stars. Monsieur Briand was often looking up at the stars. After a while, Monsieur Briand would reach up and rub Jules' nearer arm a little and say, "Been good today, Jules César," and Jules would tell him the truth. At first, he told Monsieur Briand the truth because he was perfectly safe doing so. Monsieur Briand had no jurisdiction whatever over him. Later, he told the truth because it somehow felt good to do so. He had not been in the habit of telling the truth at the school. That was part of what got him expelled. But it was a pleasant novelty to talk honestly to Monsieur Briand, and he told through most of the story of his career at Montauban, and how it had ended with the cigarette selling. Monsieur Briand had listened in silence, smoking his whatever it was, and when Jules had finally fallen into silence, had said, "Well, it's what you do now that matters." Jules had nodded, wondering what it would be. He reckoned he was old enough now that he really ought to know what he would do for a living. "Worry about the future?" asked Monsieur Briand. Jules said he did. He wasn't sure what he would do now that he was out of school. "There's a lot that needs to be done," said Monsieur Briand. The thought flickered in Jules' head that if Monsieur was a communard, he might be referring to his grand mission of planting communism. Jules had a moment's dizzying cleverness and blurted, "Like maybe helping those guerrillas in northern Indochina." As soon as the words were out of his mouth, a miserable tremor passed over him. If Monsieur Briand turned out to be anything bad, he didn't think he could stand it. The communists of post-war France possessed their share of popular respect, but Monsieur Bertraud read Bastiat, which meant that his son ignorantly disliked what the father educatedly rejected. Monsieur Briand looked directly at Jules, and Jules saw misery in his face as well. "Jules César, the communards have had me in prison for 33 years. Jules stared. "We were talking about you," said Monsieur Briand. "Well, I personally think you have a great advantage in not continuing your schooling in the lycée. You are plucked out, so to speak, from the army of young people rushing to educate themselves, and in the process flinging off almost everything good and true their parents and catechizers taught them, without taking the time to soundly and logically prove it untrue, in order to take up new and superficially intelligent ideas like relativism and crude understanding of modern poetry. I mean nihilism, the idea that nothing matters. Would you like to be a relativist and think that there's no such thing as real truth, or a nihilist who thinks that nothing matters?" Jules grunted a no. "I am saying that it is now unlikely that you will go to university, and your chances of coming to understand things rightly are consequently greater. But you are right to worry about becoming a useful adult. That is extremely important. Do you know much about, or have any interest in, what your father does?" It was no on both counts. Monsieur Briand said, "Your father is a very important man, Jules César." Jules said he supposed so. Monsieur Briand tapped Jules' knee with his pipe. "The manufacture of aircraft is integral to the recovery of France from her disastrous post-war economy. Your father is, I grant, a little mistaken in his ambition for large military contracts for his company. The best preparation of your father's company would be for the manufacture of jet-propelled passenger aircraft. In 2 or 3 years. The present knowledge of cabin pressurization is not sufficient to make extreme high-altitude flight safe. A few things need to be discovered. For the next 5 years, a sane, steady turnout of the best in piston-engine passenger craft will still be economically sound. De Havilland will get a lot of press attention with the Comet, but most airlines will continue to buy up piston-engine liners until the Comet's practicality is amply demonstrated." "Did you used to work for a plane company?" said Jules at last. "Not exactly," said Monsieur Briand. Jules wondered how Monsieur Briand had known that his father was anxious for military contracts when Jules hadn't known it himself. But he said no more, and they went inside after a little while. Jules was going upstairs, and Monsieur Briand was settling to his usual late evening occupation, when Jules remembered what he wanted to ask.
He stopped midway up the stairs, and resting his forearm on the banister, peered down into the salon, where Monsieur Briand was assembling his tools and getting out of his street coat and necktie. Jules wondered again how Monsieur Briand could work in the dark, as he did, but he asked out of the darkness of the stairwell, "Do you know my father, sir?" "Yes, very well," said Monsieur Briand, sounding a little preoccupied. He was rolling his shirt sleeves. "I'd never heard him mention you," said Jules. "Well, he doesn't know me," said Monsieur Briand, matter-of-factly, unpinning his cufflinks and folding the cuffs. "How can you know him and he not know you?" marveled Jules. "You know Alexandre Dumas, don't you? But he doesn't know you," said Monsieur Briand. "My father is not as famous as Monsieur Dumas and hasn't published anything," said Jules. "He published you," said Monsieur Briand, "and a man doesn't have to be famous to be known." Jules shrugged and went up to bed. He lay awake a long time, listening to the usual sounds of Monsieur Briand sanding the finish off the small grand piano in the salon, which Madame Betraud had not had sufficient manpower to fulfill her wish of taking with her when she removed to her parents, and which had been settling out of tune and housing mice and warping in the damp salon ever since. The sounds had become marvelously comforting to Jules night after night. The tiny squeak of pegs as Monsieur Briand tightened the strings, an occasional clear, lovely scale as Monsieur Briand tested his tuning. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, ti, la, sol, fa, mi, re, do. Sh, sh, of the old blistered finish coming off. The squeak of hinges as the lid was raised and lowered. Finally, best, the screech of legs and faintly creaking settle of the piano bench as Monsieur Briand sat down on it. And then the music. It would wash and throb and sweep up through the floor. For a few minutes, Jules would listen with purely aesthetic delight, and then his mind would begin to haul up bucket loads of memories, dreams, and associations. Now the tune was blithe and a little rollicking, whimsically divided in short beats, and a sudden pause. "What's that?" Jules called down, and Monsieur Briand called up. "That's Gavotte of Elementary Mathematics," and Jules heard 2 and 2 becoming 4, 3 and 3, 6, 4 and 4, 8. Then the song changed. Now small squadrons of notes ran at each other and became vast battalions. "Multiplication fugue in F major," called down Jules, who had heard Monsieur Briand play it before. The song changed to division toccata in F major, then the dizzying prime number scherzo in G minor. Limp, trembling, almost hysterically excited, Jules tried to lie very still so that his metal bed would not creak and drown out one note of what came next. A soft, mournful tide of sound began to be in flood downstairs. It sunk and mounted at once to a greater and greater breadth, until it reached its high C, when out of it cried the fragile, beauteous, infinitely longing voice. The bottom of the keyboard rumbled with the prieval beneficence of God, and from the middle of the keyboard, the melodious, masculine, gloriously sensible answer to the soprano cry shot up through the floorboards, to seize Jules' heart and make him cry after it. A cantabile in 1/4 time danced over the upper octaves to celebrate the reunion, and then there was no more music. Monsieur Briand's piano bench screeched an inch or two. Eventually the soft hush of the sanding block would take up again, and Jules would rub his tears off on the pillowcase, curl himself up, and at last fall asleep. The house was not undisturbed. All the north bank of Labave had perked to attention of what was happening to Charles Petro's house, and nobody walked by without looking at it. Many did more than that. Almost every neighbor on the Rue du Faubourg Las Chemines happened by in the first week or two. Madame Cassal, Mademoiselle Arnold, Mademoiselle Dornier had knocked, and without fail, Monsieur Briand opened the door and said some variation of, "Good morning, I am Monsieur Briand, the new caretaker of Monsieur Betraud's house." The visitor would then make whatever excuse she had for coming. Monsieur Briand would invite her in. "Jean César is around here somewhere. He has ceased his lycée education in order to look about him and fix on a life's vocation. Jules César is getting to be quite a young man. Saint-Céré will be proud of him." Jules César managed to absent himself every time the door knocker sounded, much less sure that Saint-Céré would be proud of him, or divulge anything complimentary to the elder Monsieur Betraud. Saint-Céré developed a high approval of caretaker Briand and his work, and a monstrous curiosity about Jules César. No one knew much about him beyond the general memory of what he had looked like before he went to Montauban, and his ridiculous given name. The old surmisings of what Monsieur Bitrot had done to make his wife leave him were rehashed, but there was little to be said that had not already been said. Invitations to dinner and to tea flooded in. Jules looked them over, and then showed them, as he showed almost everything, to Monsieur Briand. Monsieur Briand weeded them quite efficiently. The Beauchamp only want to find out scandal about your father. Mademoiselle Aigle was a friend of your mother's and wants to be kind to you for her sake. Louis Pichon wants to see if he can make you drunk. The sisters Pierson are related to your father and are very poor now, but have spent more than they can afford on a pot of marmalade for your visit. The Lauriers, Jules went to see the deserving people, was polite, and answered questions about his father with enthusiastic recitals of how important his father's work was, and how air manufacture was the future of France. But Jules had begun to notice an odd thing when he was out at people's houses. He was constantly missing Monsieur Briand. To walk home and see Monsieur Briand's pipe through the gloom of the Rue du Faubourg made him whole again. He never considered anything now without considering how Monsieur Briand would see it. There was never anything unpleasant in his thoughts about Monsieur Briand. Could not be. He had never seen Monsieur Briand angry, thoughtless, selfish, or even too preoccupied to pay attention to his young friend. Jules wondered a good deal about Monsieur Briand's past, and asked about it now and then. But his inability to picture the man's background did not come from a lack of information, but too much of it. Jules could not find a way to piece it all together into a single life of 48 or 9 years. And how Monsieur Briand could be the mere 48 or 9 he looked seemed impossible. He had talked with what could hardly be anything but reminiscent familiarity of the Prussian siege of Paris, and yet to have been born during the siege, Monsieur Briand would have to be 77. Jules concluded that Monsieur Briand must have done a tremendous lot of reading, in some past period, for he never read anything now. And before much of the historical talk had transpired, Jules had not been sure that the man could read at all. On April 19th, Jules and the caretaker had resided in the house 2 weeks. Jules calculated that the 6-month term that Monsieur Briand had mentioned would end on September 4th, and he was already dreading it. He was making heaps of plans, because he knew that when Monsieur Briand left, he would not be able to think any more like before, so he had to have the locomotive of his adulthood well steamed up and underway before then, and maybe it could carry him into the future on its own power. For he was sure that he would have none of his own when Monsieur Briand left, and he was also sure that his father would not allow a caretaker appointed by the mayor and corporation to stay 1 day longer than he was legally forced to. Jules had talked more with Monsieur Briand about the airplane industry, and Monsieur Briand had ignited him with enthusiasm for it. Jules fired off a letter to the Air Administration, the General Direction of Civil and Commercial Aviation, asking what training was necessary to a commercial pilot's license. Another letter to the International Federation of Aeronautics. He wrote to Hispano Suiza, Mercedes, and Rolls-Royce for parts magazines, and hauled all the pamphlets and promotional flyers on his father's company, which had been stored under the dining table in the unused dining room, up to his room and read them. He wanted to go in 50 directions at once. He wanted to be a test pilot, a mechanic, a chief executive officer. He tacked a picture of an American Boeing B-47 jet bomber and a picture of General de Gaulle over his bed. End of part 2.
Monsieur Briand by Sarah Johnson, part 3. The Rolls-Royce catalogue came. It was in English. Jules found his English very inadequate. He finally asked Monsieur Briand if he knew any English and what did the terms air-cooled, turbine, exclusive, depending, etc. mean in French. Monsieur Briand's English was instant and faultless. Jules, with the renewing, or rather inception, of his adult ambitions, began to realize that in the life he was planning, it might be extremely useful to know English. He had already planned extensive visits, perhaps even internships, at Boeing, Douglas, de Havilland, Vickers, and he got around very respectfully and deferentially to asking Monsieur Briand if there was any way he would tutor him a little in English. Monsieur Briand's ideas of English tutoring were very congenial. He had Jules read his aircraft literature aloud in French, and translated it sentence by sentence into English. Joel picked up English the way he had picked up French. Monsieur Briand ordained Wednesday and Friday as English days, when nothing else could be spoken. He told Joel to twist wire around his radio antenna and run about 5 meters of wire out of his bedroom window and onto the roof, so as to pick up English radio stations. Joel picked up more. Aeronautic weather reports from Lyon, Toulouse, Saint-Cyr. He lay on his back on the steep roof at night, trying to teach himself astronomical navigation with a flashlight and a map of the stars, torn out of one of his encyclopedias, and trying to steel himself to danger and extreme altitudes. That roof provided plenty of both, at the same time. The radio was on his windowsill, droning into the branches of the pear tree the even, measured voice of an air traffic controller at Rome. Level your approach. Descending 2500. Approaching on flight path. Monsieur Briand never played the piano on nights when Jules was on the roof. He had finished his work on it. It was a very beautiful, perfectly new-looking piano now. Each ivory and ebony key had been taken out and cleaned, and all the brass polished. Looking at it made Jules want to write to his mother. He had harbored a bitter anger against her for 6 years, at her leaving him and his father, but his old memory of how she liked to play the piano had only a little wistful sweetness in it when he looked at the lovely instrument. For it looked now as it had looked on the day when the movers brought it in, when she was the younger, the innocent mother he did not hate, before the day that she left and he suddenly discovered she was hateable. And he composed, one evening, a fragment of a letter. Dear Mama, you ought to see your piano. The new caretaker, Monsieur Briand, has polished it up, and it is simply beautiful. It looks like new. My English is improving very much. Here he wrote from memory a line from the Rolls-Royce catalogue in English. Monsieur Briand is tutoring me. I wish you— Here he stopped, crumpled the paper savagely, and threw it under the bed. The next day was Sunday. Jules did not want to go to church, where people would ask him why he had come back from Montauban, and Monsieur Briand never went to church. Jules was not too sure where Monsieur Briand was all morning, and hung around the house, tried to amuse himself with his aircraft literature, tried to cut his own hair, put a hat on, and in the afternoon went out and walked across Saint-Céré to the house of his former classmate, Juju de Lepopi, to whom he had paid no attention since leaving grammar school for Montauban, but now sought in his loneliness. Juju appeared quite pleased to see him, asked him about Montauban, showed him his gun and a few prize wing feathers of ducks he had taken in hunting. Juju was at his full height now, delivered groceries by bicycle, and had a small beard. He was getting together with a few friends at the tavern tonight, he said. Would Joel like to come? Why, if he was old enough to quit school, he was old enough to go to the tavern. Joel was very lonely, but then it was likely that the glow of Monsieur Briand's pipe would greet him on the Rue du Faubourg. Joel missed being with boys his own age, but then, being with Juju had not been very exhilarating. Joel felt that he ought to go and do a few things while he was young and newly free of school, instead of just hanging around holding painting ladders and studying English. Ah, that was something. Joel went. He had never been in the tavern, although he had looked in the door. He stared curiously at the bottle-lined walls. Juju's friends appeared and were introduced to Joel. They were not very inspiring fellows, but their eyes seemed to gleam with new wit as they praised the bottles on the wall behind the counter. Jules saw rather suddenly that they were all dull-witted, pre-alcoholic clods. The dimness of the tavern was instantly the very pall of shame over them all. Jules actually shuddered. He thought of what Monsieur Briand would think about all this, and he got quickly to his feet, told Juju he had to leave, and left. He walked back through the darkening streets, hastening to find that small light glowing down Rue du Faubourg. He knew Monsieur Briand would rub his arm and say, "Been good today, Jean César," and he knew he would tell the truth, but somehow he was not dreading it. Though he was ashamed of what he had done, he was not afraid of telling Monsieur Briand about it. He so loved to listen when Monsieur Briand told him things that he knew now that whatever Monsieur Briand said, it would heal this sickness and sorrow. He could bear it even if Monsieur Briand decided to be fierce with him, because he knew it was making him good. He had never been so good in his life, as now that Monsieur Briand had come,
and he loved this goodness. The pipe was glowing down the Rue du Faubourg. Joel picked up his speed and came up to it. He leaned against the house wall, trying not to divulge by panting that he had been hurrying. He waited for the hand. When it came, it was better than he had imagined, alive and independent of him, but of its own will, rubbing his elbow 2 or 3 seconds, just what he had needed. "Been good today, Jean César?" Joel told him. Monsieur Briand took a long, slow pull at his pipe, and blew it meditatively out of the nose, a signal that he had heard and understood. Joel leaned against the wall. "Well," said Monsieur Briand, "that's all right, Jean César." Joel did not quite know why, but something was making him terribly sad, rather like parts of the music Monsieur Briand played on the piano. He sighed, put his arm up against the wall, and leaned his head on it. He stood that way a little while, as Monsieur Briand smoked, and the smell of rose petals drifted up from the bowl of the pipe. After a moment, Joel had to sniff and bring his right sleeve up to his eyes for a second. "Something wrong, Jean César," said Monsieur Briand gently. "I don't know. It seems like something's missing out of life. Something very good, I don't know." Monsieur Briand sucked thoughtfully on his pipe. "I'm not very good, monsieur." "No," said Monsieur Briand, "you're not." This would have surprised Joel to hear, except that it was the truth, and he had become used to hearing the truth from Monsieur Briand. "I would like to be good," he said humbly. "Do you mean that?" said Monsieur Briand. Joel thought of the shame of the late-night gossip in the dormitory in Montauban, and of lying awake, listening to Monsieur Briand playing the piano. The difference was light and darkness, and he knew what he wanted. "Yes, I mean it." "What is stopping you?" said Monsieur Briand. Joel was surprised at this expression of moral willy-nilliness until he realized that the question had not been rhetorical, but a serious question to be answered. "Me," said Joel. "How would you like to be free of that?" said Monsieur Briand. "How?" warbled Joel, thoroughly baffled. "How would you say?" "Well, I'd say that the only way to be free of me would be to be dead." "Have you died?" Joel wondered where this conversation was going, and about Monsieur Briand's sanity. The unsupervised part of his mental process suggested briefly that if there was anything the matter with the sanity of someone like Monsieur Briand, it was not the oddness of insanity, but supersanity. "No, sir." "Do you suppose anyone could be dead for you and transfer the benefits?" This was out of what Joel could rationalize. "I don't know, sir," he said honestly. "It'd have to be someone with, like, supernormal, arbitrary power over matter, time, space," mused Monsieur Briand. Joel agreed. After a while, because he believed he could take even Monsieur Briand's bizarre statement, normalize, and keep the conversation going, he valued conversation with Monsieur Briand like he valued his breakfast and night's sleep. Joel said, "That's not a bad idea. I wish you were right, that there are a way for what's bad of me to be dead and me to be good." "I want you to see something," said Monsieur Briand. He unbuttoned his jacket, then his shirt, and pulled the placket hem back to expose part of his left side. He blew into the bowl of the pipe and held it close to his side. Joel bent and saw, in the small flare of light, a pretty deep gouge in the flesh, roughly over where the heart would be, large enough to insert several fingers into, healed over with only a thin film of skin. "Mon Dieu!" croaked Joel without knowing it. "You ought to be dead." Monsieur Briand did not say anything. He sucked on the pipe again, and blew a cloud of smoke into the air, overpowering it with the humid sweetness of June roses. Joel's head reeled backward a centimeter. The smell was that of a funeral he must have been to, before he could properly remember. A smell full of infantile confusion and horror. Joel sensed instantly on recognizing the smell that Monsieur Briand was telling him something with it, and before he could take the time to fully process the idea of a man who could talk in smells, exclaimed, "You were dead." "For you," said Monsieur Briand simply, ending his smoke. He tapped the ashes out of his pipe against the arm of the iron chair, stood up, and went inside. Jules remained, standing by the chair, staring up at the stars without seeing, adrift in oceanic thoughts. Finally, he tiptoed into the house. Monsieur Briand was in the salon, not in total darkness as usual. The electricity had not been turned on, but Monsieur Briand had lit the small kerosene lamp from the kitchen shelf and set it on the mantel. He was seated on the piano bench, the only seat in the room, but had dragged it away from the piano. He was not wearing any of the expressions that Jules had seen men wear, even good men, when they were alone in the room. A smile spread and waned on his lips, and his head moved slightly as if he were watching something lovely and fascinating. Jules could not see anything in that direction. He came softly into the room, and Monsieur Briand turned toward him. "Jules César, you are not afraid of me." Jules had thought that he was, but when he looked at Monsieur Briand's face, he could not be. He could not fear while he loved. He crossed over to him. Monsieur Briand looked up into his face and smiled, and Jules forgot being 16. He knelt down against Monsieur Briand's knee, took hold of his hand, and rested his cheek against it, and let his chest and shoulders heave and his throat sob for a little while. When his paroxysm had subsided, he let his head rest there a little, and then lifted his face. He was not embarrassed. He could never be embarrassed with Monsieur Briand, but a new discovery was fomenting. "I think," said Jules rather huskily as soon as he could talk, "that you're not really used to being a man. I mean that you, who I think I'm seeing right now, and used to seeing, is really only a picture of something or the tip of some kind of iceberg." Monsieur Briand smiled. "Yes, Jules César." "Please," said Jules, "I don't think I need the picture anymore. That's for babies. Please. I need you real. Please take off your disguise." "Are you sure?" said Monsieur Briand. "You're still in that low level of consciousness. If I take off this crude guise, your eyes won't be able to perceive me, and your crude brain has a hard time believing things you can't see with your eyes." "Please, please," begged Jules. "I don't want a baby's ideas of you. I'm not a baby." "All right," said Monsieur Briand. Jules was suddenly leaning against an empty piano bench. It is true that his lower consciousness was bewildered for a couple of seconds, but then he leaped to his feet. "Hooray! Vive Monsieur Briand!" The room was empty. The house was empty. The kerosene lamp made a faint sputtering in the silence. But Jules knew. He tumbled to his knees on the floor and worshipped the true, the worthy, the unguessed at Jesus Christ. For if Christ had continued to manifest himself in a caretaker in a brown suit, 48 or 9, or even a colossal angel covering half the sky and glowing with the northern lights, Jules could hardly have been expected to worship a thing he knew was smaller than the Milky Way. But he had no excuse now. At last he went into the kitchen, repasted it on bread, butter, and cheese, and climbed the stairs to bed. No piano music came up through the floor now, but now Jules didn't cry for anything either. He knew Monsieur Briand, and knew that he was there, and that he would be with him to the end of his life. Jules felt that his own consciousness was allowing itself to become an extension of Monsieur Briand's. He didn't mind. Monsieur Briand was immensely good, and Jules was good now and could do anything. He stayed awake to love and to plan a little while and then fell asleep. End of part 3.
Monsieur Briand by Sarah Johnson, part 4. The anxiously awaited letter from the General Direction of Civil and Commercial Aviation came that Monday. Jules had snatched it from the floor under the mail slot, read the return address, and dashed up to his room, where he had been diligently listening to the English radio at 9 o'clock, the hour he had done his English with Monsieur Briand, and then, in his overwhelming triumph at finding a real future for himself, he tuned the radio carefully to pick up Toulouse air traffic control, twisted up the volume, crawled out into the pear tree, and climbed onto the roof, in broad daylight. All Saint-Séguin could see him in his observatory, reading his letter from the office of the Secretary of Civil and Commercial Aviation. Jules César Bétrault was going to be a pilot. There was a knock on the front door, 3 stories below. Jules, of course, heard nothing over the buzz of the radio,
the rustle of the pear tree, and the hum and crackle of his ambitions as he memorized the letter. The woman knocking on the door was long acquainted with that door's latch, and realizing that it was not locked, turned the knob and went in. The cleanliness and order of the inside of the house astonished her as much as the outside had. She stepped slowly through the entryway, peered into the tidy kitchen, cluttered with nothing more than an unwrapped half-bread loaf and slightly crumbed butter dish, and into the salon, empty but for a gorgeous piano. "Jules César," she called. There was no answer, but as she neared the stairwell, a droning voice became louder. She hurried up, clutching her silk bag and very chic hat. The door of Jules' room was open. She came in nervously, slowly, and perceived the radio blaring to loose air traffic control, the open window, the clean but rumpled bed, the parts catalogues, pamphlets, an English book, Charles Bethreau's copy of Julius Caesar, from which he had named his son, De Gaulle and the B-47. Her heart did something odd and her eyes got wet. She had no idea where this suddenly adult son was. She sat down on the bed, and then, as if to reassure herself, took a crinkled letter out of her silk bag and read it again. Then she stepped over to the radio and turned it off so as to listen. Jules heard the radio blink off and reckoned that the battery was dead. He was minded to take it downtown to look for an electrician and see if he could get it recharged, and tell some human being that he was going to be a pilot. He came crackling down the pear tree with the letter in his teeth, got his head and shoulders in the window, and saw his mother. How she had gotten his letter was a rock-solid mystery to him for 6 or 7 seconds. Then he realized that Monsieur Briand must have mailed it. He did not tell his mother anything beyond Saint-Cyr's ideas of Monsieur Briand, though she was too pretty, and he remembered far too much good of her, not to almost entirely forgive her in the first half hour. But he told her he had become a Christian. She had no idea, of course, how much excellent companionship he had had in the past 3 weeks, and the thought of how lonely he must have been nearly broke her heart. Recognizing with the fine-edged perception behind her fine-edged nose how ridiculous it would be to urge him over to Aurillac, she said she would stay a couple of days, if Jules wouldn't tell his father, and if his father didn't come. She insisted on immediate warning if he did come, so that she could go down the pear tree. She found the house in amazing order, except, as she said rather smugly, a few things your Monsieur Briand couldn't do because only a woman would think of them. The linen cupboard, for example, was shocking. Jules couldn't understand it. That cupboard had been immaculately stocked and organized while Monsieur Briand had been about, and Jules hadn't touched it since before Monsieur Briand left. Madame Bethreau was a better cook than Monsieur Briand, and played the piano at night too. Not nearly so well as Monsieur Briand, but in her own distantly familiar way, which was pleasant, even humbly lovely. Jules had felt the translated, universal Monsieur Briand trying to communicate to his human density several times that it was time to write his father and tell him about the expulsion and what he wanted to do with his life. Finally, Jules fortified himself with ink and paper, locked his bedroom door, turned up the Norbonne weather report, and got down to it. Out of the lycée, he never made multiple drafts of anything, so it was blackened with crossouts, for he had decided to write it in English. 25 April, 1950. My dear father, it is very time I tell you that I am not at school at Montauban now. In April 2, a paragraph followed. My great desire is to become an aircraft engineer, but I must be a pilot first because, to be an engineer, I must know how a plane flies. I wrote to the International Aeronautic Federation about the training to be a commercial pilot. I do not want to be an army pilot, as Mr. Bright, as Jules César had known no better than to clumsily translate Briand as well as Monsieur, says that airplane manufacture is part of the recovery of France from her very bad after-war economy. You said you will pay for my education until I have 18 years. He meant am 18 years old. There are 2 years left, and I beg you consider paying my fees at the National School of Civil Aviation, or at the SALS Aviation School in Carcassonne, which is in some things better. It is closer. If you will, I will keep good record of my fees and pay you back when I have my career. The house looks very wonderful. Mr. Bright painted and put back up the chimney, scraped the green plants off the wall, Jules did not bother to look up moss in the English-French dictionary, and mistook wall for roof. And also fixed the stair fence. He is gone now. Rather gone. I wish you good health. I am well. From your son, Julius Caesar. The letter had to be forwarded twice from the Lyon address Monsieur Guillaume was able to give Jules, before it reached Monsieur Bethot, now in Paris. Monsieur Bethot looked angry over the first paragraph, surprised and then slightly pleased by the second, and quite puzzled by the third. He went to find a telephone. Monsieur Bethot was not sufficiently important to have a telephone within arm's reach when he was in Paris, and rang up Monsieur Guillaume. "Who is this Mr. Bright, and what authority does he have to be working on my house?" Monsieur Guillaume knew a little English, and divined that Bright was Bouillon. He passed on Saint-Cyr's ideas about caretaker Bouillon. Monsieur Guillaume was strongly recommended to contact the mayor and make him uncomfortable by every tactic known to the law. Monsieur Guillaume got around to it within a day or two, and learned that the mayor knew nothing about a Monsieur Bouillon, except that the Bethot house had begun to look decent again, and might become eligible for a slight change in property tax based on its increased value. In the meantime, Monsieur Bethot wrote back to his son in much better English, saying many things, among them that some actual flying knowledge might be useful in a career of aeronautic engineering, but his general baccalaureate, or high school accreditation, was absolutely necessary. The Jules' English had improved, Monsieur Bethot did not admit had begun to exist, that if he were truly interested in the flight manufacturing industry, Monsieur Bethot could probably eventually get him placed in any number of positions in his still-formative company. The day the letter came, Jules had gone to the birthday party of one of his old teachers in the Saint-Cyr Grammar School, who, on turning 80, with a chalk and ruler still in hand, was celebrated as a regional accomplishment, and treated with the treat of 382 present and former students, invited to the gymnasium for cake, a sugar ration cake, very healthy, water, and speeches. The tactful suggestion on the invitations to the effect that birthday gifts were discouraged resulted in about 90 kilos of assorted things wrapped in every sort of paper you can imagine, a paper pretty scarce still in Saint-Cyr, which the gracious Monsieur Egmont opened with appropriate sentiments of thanks in a ceremony that required an hour 45 minutes and rotating shifts of assistance, and all the foodstuffs of which, 50 kilos, he put in a crate and several thicknesses of vari-colored paper and shipped off to the Red Cross for Austria the next day. Jules had wondered for a day and a half what to bring his beloved Monsieur Egmont that could express all his gratitude and yet not be too much like a birthday gift, forbidden in the note, and unlike all the female alumni, had not fixed on a pot of jam. It's not like a birthday present, he'll eat it up, but rather his precious American newspaper picture of the Boeing B-47, with the bashfully proud murmur that I, Monsieur Egmont, because of you, will be smart enough to be building planes like these in 4 or 5 years. Monsieur Egmont had been using his mouth a long, long time, and his smile, when he smiled it, was very large and full of sunshine and blessing. "Bravo, Jules César, my boy, bravo! You are really going to be an airplane builder!" "Engineer," corrected Jules, smiling proudly from his one ear to his other. Monsieur Egmont, on his throne of tables, held the picture aloft where the audience of several hundred could try to see it, and announced, "Jules César Bethot is going to learn how to build airplanes. I am going to stick this picture of a what is it?" he murmured to Jules. "Boeing B-47 jet-propelled bomber. Of a jet-propelled bombing plane on my wall at home, because when I see a plane that looks like this one, but much bigger and faster, fly over, I'll be able to say, that's one of my boy Jules César's birds." Jules had floated home from the birthday party, and found his father's letter in the wire basket on the mantelpiece. Letters were not let lie on the floor under the slot while Madame Bethot was on duty. She had stayed a week now, with no signs of leaving as long as Charles kept away, but was in a flutter for Jules to get home, read the Charlesian letter, and tell her whether she would have time to escape out of the front door, or whether it would be necessary to go down the pear tree. Jules read his letter. The idea of going back to Lycée made him frown and grimace horribly, but success, tearlessly. Then made him walk up and down the room, made him glance his agonized apology to General de Gaulle in France, made him press his face to the blank space on the wall where the B-47 picture had been, exhaling heavily through his nose, and finally made him spread the letter out on the bed and say, "Read it, Monsieur Briand." Jules could not have told you exactly how he and Monsieur Briand communicated now. He consulted Monsieur Briand as he consulted the multiplication table. "There are summer holidays," said Monsieur Briand. "Have your father get a letter of introduction for you from the head of his corporation and take a summer job with Soot Aviation in Toulouse. Or try to take an on-the-ground class of a few weeks in aviation mechanics at the Carcassonne School. Meanwhile, you have an excellent opportunity to study physics, geometry, commerce, and English while you are in Lycée. Study very well, but do not let up while you are awake, because you may not be there long. An ambitious boy can find a way to finish his last 2 years of Lycée in 1 year, if he is wise to make friends of his teachers and director immediately. Write your father about this. Also write to the International Federation of Aeronautics for a list of the best books on aerodynamics and order a couple from their printers. Your mathematics professor can help you with them. Try to work out a balanced schedule of study, so that you don't slack, neglect the important but less intriguing Lycée subjects, or burn yourself out." Jules got up from sprawling across his bed, and went down to quietly and confidently harangue his mother in the dark. Madame Bethlot was not going to pay her husband's electricity bill. About what he was going to do. Then he lit the kerosene lamp so that he could read in the Bible for a little while. His excitement, on finding that he could read about Monsieur Briand and what he had been doing in his past, was almost insupportable. He found himself reading now in Luke of the Resurrection. He became more thrilled than was containable. "Mamma, listen to this. They said unto him, 'Why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spoke unto you while he was yet in Galilee, saying, The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men, and be crucified, and the third day rise again.'" "Hmm," said Madame Bethlot. She was buffing her fingernails where there was some light. She was very domestically involved in the daytime, and her fingernails took a beating. "That's the only book I've seen you read all week, besides those airplane magazines. You need to keep up on your literature, being out of school like this. What about some Victor Hugo?" She got up to go to the attic, where she thought a decayed copy of The Hunchback of Notre Dame might be among a box of books that had been left up there. Jules put out the lamp, and stared, furious and sorrowful, into the dark. "Monsieur, how can I be so rich alone? How can they not know?" "Ah, oh, monsieur, once I did not know." "How? How can I tell them?" He puzzled over it, trying and rejecting different wordings of an introduction to the story, in the darkness of the salon, which could never be very dark to him again since the nights when he had listened to Monsieur Briand working in it. And upstairs, his mother labored in the dark through the box of mildewed books, looking for the Hugo book, and not even sure how she would know it when she found it. The end.